You're listening to Ocean Currents, a podcast brought to you by NOAA's Cordell Bank National Marine Sanctuary. This show was originally broadcast on KWMR in Point Reyes Station, California. Thanks for listening. Another edition of Ocean Currents. I'm your host, Jennifer Stock. On this show, we talk with scientists, educators, explorers, policymakers, ocean enthusiasts, authors, and more, all uncovering and learning about the mysterious and vital part of our planet, the blue ocean. I bring this show to you monthly from NOAA's Cordell Bank National Marine Sanctuary, one of four national marine sanctuaries in California, all working to protect unique and biologically diverse ecosystems. And just offshore of our KWMR listening area on the West Marin Coast are the Greater Farallones and Cordell Bank National Marine Sanctuaries, which together protect 4,581 square miles. Without sex or joining of gametes in the ocean, there would be no ocean life today. And we talk a lot on this show about ocean conditions and threats and habitat and ecosystem integrity, uses of the ocean and more, but what it really comes down to every day is the ability for animals to get it on. Our local national marine sanctuaries are trying to set the right dating scene to optimize this important life history stage. So I'm thrilled to welcome back Mara Hart, author of the book Sex in the Sea. Mara is a creative writer and storyteller, a scientist, and works at the crossroads of research, creative communication, and strategy to build a sustainable future for people and the sea. She currently works as a research director for a nonprofit systems change incubator called The Future of Fish. I'm so happy to welcome back Mara to Ocean Currents. Mara, you are live on the air.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for calling in. So I thought we talked a little bit before our show about where we might go with our time here. And I thought we have been doing so much work here on the West Coast to learn more about the deep sea environment that plunges below 1,000 feet and goes way beyond 8 to 10,000 feet. Right now, there is a wonderful expedition happening on the Nautilus in the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And last week, they saw this amazing Dumbo octopus. And I just thinking about life in the deep and how do they reproduce? And there's corals and invertebrates. So I wanted to give you some time to talk about deep sea species and how they reproduce.
Deep sea sex. I love it. It's a great topic, and the fact that nowadays the technology and the ocean exploration has gotten to the point where we really can bring this incredible and really alien environment right into our homes, like you said, with the Nautilus, that folks can be watching this live as the scientists are discovering, it's amazing, and we are able to see so much more now. And really, when it comes to reproduction in the deep sea, one of the things that holds true that we see in other aspects of deep sea life is extremes. So we know that in the deep sea, animals are dealing with incredible pressure. They're dealing with incredible temperatures, very cold environments, very dark environments. And they've adapted to deal with this extreme environment in all sorts of ways, and that includes how they reproduce. And one of my favorite examples of this is a set of animals known as ossidacs. So these are really great to talk about right before Halloween because they're also known as zombie worms, zombie bone-eating worms. So I thought they would be a fun example. And they were discovered actually just near the Monterey Canyon about 15 years ago now. And when scientists first went down and were kind of exploring the environment, they came across a whale fall. So this is a dead carcass of a whale that had sunk into the bottom. And they noticed that the bones were covered in this sort of red fuzz. And as they approached closer, they realized that these bright red sort of filaments were worms. They were a new kind of deep sea worm. And there was a couple things the scientists noticed right away that were really strange about these animals. The first thing was that they had no mouth and no gut, right? So that's kind of weird. And instead, what they do is these worms have sort of like fibrous tendrils at the base where they attach into the bone, and they grow almost like these root-like structures. And they dissolve the bone, and then the protein and fat that's trapped in the bone kind of absorbs into the worm and is actually digested by bacteria that live in these tendrils of the worm, and then the worm feeds off the bacteria. So it's this really weird system, and it's almost more plant-like than animal-like. But then the other thing that's really strange that the scientists discovered was that all of the worms that they saw were females. Every single one of them had fully developed ovaries. And in fact, they also had these tiny little black dots inside that looked like sperm, and some of them were releasing fertilized eggs. And so the scientists were faced with this strange question of like, okay, well, we have all these female worms. We know that the males have to be around because there's fertilized eggs, but where are the males? It took them over a year. It was the case of the missing males. They were trying to figure out where these males could be. And one of the researchers by the name of Dr. Greg Rouse, he works down at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, he decided one night after about a year to put some samples of these worms under a very, very high-powered microscope. And so he's, you know, late at night in the lab, and he's zooming in and zooming in and zooming in. And finally, he makes this discovery that those tiny little black specks that they thought were sperm were actually males. They were, the individual males were 100,000 times smaller than the female.
Wow.
It's the biggest, it's mind-boggling. It's the biggest size difference between a male and a female that we know of in the animal kingdom. And so now that they've discovered the males, they're trying to figure out, you know, what is happening here, right? Because this is not a system like we see on land, right? You don't go on a farm and see this kind of a mating pair. And it turns out that the tiny little males, not only are they just microscopic little dwarf males, but there's other really strange characteristics, which is that they look more like juveniles than adults. The only adult feature that they have is fully grown testes. So they're actually basically larval worms that have fully grown testes, and they ejaculate sperm out of pores in the tops of their heads while living inside the female.
This is not a good Halloween costume.
No. Or a really good Halloween costume, but very bizarre.
Well, I guess so.
Yeah. So what they think happens is, it makes sense if you take a step back and you think about how these worms are living out their life, right? And so, again, they live off of whale bones or other large marine animals that fall to the floor, mostly mammals. And so it's a very limited food supply. And the females need a lot of energy to produce eggs. Eggs are an energy-intensive thing to produce. Sperm is cheap. So the males can produce a ton of sperm without actually needing that many nutrients. And so what we think happens, it's still being sorted out, but the hypothesis is that the first worms to sort of come out of the ocean and see that there's a whale fall and land on the bones, they develop as females. So they grow bigger. They're about the length of your finger, and they develop their ovaries, and they feed off of the bones. As that whale gets covered in these worms and the food supply starts to run a little thin, then the latecomers, the larval worms that are sort of arriving late to the party, there's potentially the females release a chemical signature that stunts the larval worm's growth. So they sort of freeze. And the only part of them that actually matures is testes. And so instead of becoming fully grown females and growing on the bones, they swim down the worm tubes. They actually form little clusters around the female's ovaries. And as the eggs are released, they just hang out there, pumping sperm out of their heads, fertilizing the eggs. And they live off of the reserve from the yolk sac from when they hatched. And then they die. And that's it.
Amazing.
So the female collects these harems of males, these microscopic males, throughout her lifetime until the bones basically run out of fuel, and then they all move on.
So where do they go? Because when they eat up the whale bones and the whale fall community is
right,
somewhat dissolved, do they just kind of float around to the next community?
Well, it's a good question. I think, and I'm not 100% certain, but my understanding is that the females kind of live out their life on that whale fall, and it's the released eggs, the fertilized eggs, that then go off into the Black Sea and sort of float around until they then hatch, and then probably using their smell, sense of smell, hone in on the next whale fall. So I think the adults live and die on that one whale fall, and then spend the time kind of drifting around as larvae until the next set of bones. So I think once they've rooted, I don't think they can release. My understanding is that they're kind of permanently attached until the food supply runs out, and then they die.
It's just another amazing story about how much we don't know about the deep sea, but the fact we know about these worms is absolutely phenomenal to me in terms of the biology and figuring out all these mysteries that are such an important...
There's like 20 different species or more than 20 different kinds of these ossidacs now that we've discovered in just the, in less than 2 decades.
I'm going to look up during the break. I did a show with, I can't remember the name of the scientist, but it was all about the whale fall community. And we talked about ossidax worms before. This is many years ago. So it's fun to hear about them again and a little bit more about their details.
Their intimate lives.
Unbelievable. Worms. Well, let's go on to something a little bit more familiar with people, the cephalopods of the deep. Last week, I happened to be watching Nautilus. So nautiluslive.org, as Mara was mentioning, is streaming live video from the deep sea feeds that they're doing in the Monterey Bay Sanctuary. I think they're transiting right now to another dive site, but I happened to be watching when a Dumbo octopus appeared, and it was just so beautiful, and it was incredible, and the visibility was just amazing. And how do they find mates down there?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and you know, cephalopods in general, so octopus, cuttlefish, squid, like they're such a phenomenal group, and in the deep sea, it can be really, really tricky, and a lot of times it is, we see that animals do use scent, is a big, asset when you're, because obviously visually it's hard to see, down there. And so currents help, sort of pass hormones or pheromones along and they can find one another that way. They don't, when it comes to octopus, they don't tend to, form groups like we see, say, with some fish, and have, you know, big annual orgies. So it really is a question of finding a mate, and when you find them, being able to mate with them safely. and for octopus, there's some big challenges because if a male does encounter a female, oftentimes we do see that a female is bigger, and she can often be very aggressive. And octopus do need to have contact to mate. So they have internal fertilization. So the male has to deliver sperm to the female, and the female then takes that sperm and brings it inside into a chamber where she can fertilize her eggs. And so and then she lays the eggs. And there's some really neat facts about deep sea octopus and the role of motherhood, and we can talk about that in a second. But the way that the male transfers the sperm to the female can take a lot of different forms. So with many bottom-dwelling octopus, what tends to happen is the male has a special arm called a hectocotylus. Sort of fancy name, but it's basically the sperm-carrying arm. And so a challenge I can put out to all of you who like to eat octopus or squid, actually, shallow water squid have this too. You can look for this specialized tentacle in your calamari and see and be able to tell whether you're eating a male or a female. But the males often you'll see do these very, very long reaches. They basically try to sneak up on the female as much as they can, and then they just quickly kind of pat her on the back. So it's a real quick smack. And then they're out of there as fast as they can. And so it's a really quick process and done with as much distance as possible. And there's a wonderful example. It's not deep sea, but of an octopus called the Argonaut. which is a pelagic octopus. So they don't live on the bottom. And I'm curious, for anybody else who is listening or octopus experts out there, whether octopus like the Dumbo octopus that are also midwater would have something similar. But this Argonaut is known because the males are much smaller than the females. And so they are at great risk of being attacked during mating. And so evolution and all her mighty creativity has come up with a strategy where the Argonaut male can actually detach his hectocotylus. So he can sever his own arm, and it wiggles its way over to the female as an independent body and then kind of attaches to her side. Now, he dies when this happens, so it's kind of a one-shot deal. But it's basically a way of having a detachable penis so that he can just sort of throw it on out there. It wiggles its way the last, you know, couple of feet to the female and lodges itself up under her mantle so that she then can go on and draw draw the sperm and fertilize her eggs. So, yeah, detachable penises are a thing with cephalopods, which is kind of crazy. We see it in some snails, too. So the mollusk world seems to allow for some extreme mating techniques.
Unbelievable. Now, I think the Argonaut is also has been misnamed the Nautilus. It's like a Nautilus shell, and many people call a Nautilus when it's actually an Argonaut, right?
Correct. So the common name for an Argonaut is paper Nautilus, and it gets very confused with the actual Nautilus, the animal that, yeah, has that brown and white spiraled shell. The paper Nautilus, so it's a cephalopod that creates a very thin, truly like paper-like egg chamber. And so it's called the Argonaut because back in the ancient times, they thought that it used this egg chamber to float like a sail on the surface and carry it over the sea for movement. So they named it, you know, the Argonaut after the sailors. So, but yes, it's different than the Nautilus.
Interesting. I actually found one of those paper Nautilus chambers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, unbelievable. This is years ago in my 20s. I used to teach at Catalina Island Marine Institute. And one of my weeks there, I found a paper Nautilus on the beach.
Oh, my gosh. That's amazing because they're so delicate.
I know. And it's just crazy to me that 20-something years later is now I'm just learning more about what that animal's actually about. We didn't have internet on the island.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, the males are really rare. So they're very, very hard to find. In fact, I think there's only been a handful even ever found live. Again, they're very small and they have this very bizarre, you know, life history. So there's still so much to learn about so many of these animals. You know, it's mind blowing.
Welcome back. You're tuned to KWMR here in West Marin, and I'm thrilled to have Mara Hart on the air with us, author of Sex and the Sea, and we've been discussing some very interesting biology that happens in the ocean to keep life alive and thriving. You know, and one of the things that I read towards the end of your book was just how resilient, how eager animals are to reproduce, and that even when there's challenging conditions and environmental challenges, they're so resilient and so eager to reproduce. So it's a matter of just keeping this balance of the conditions right for organisms to continue to thrive.
Yeah, and I think what we forget is that the way, you know, life is structured is it's all about survival and sex. And the truth is, in terms of the rules of evolution, if you don't have the sex, then surviving actually doesn't matter. So animals do everything they can, including sacrificing themselves, just to be able to have the chance to reproduce. And so that drive is something that is incredibly strong. And if we just get out of the way, it will move forward. And so I think one of the things that I try to talk about with Sex and the Sea is we often feel that the ocean is so far away. It's this environment that we sort of see the surface of or skirt the edges of. But the fact is our activities really can affect these animals at that most fundamental level of reproduction. And if we can sort of take a step back and just try to say, you know, maybe when they're all getting together for their one time a year giant sex bout, that's not the best time to be fishing them, right? Mm. We should leave them alone. You know, it's sort of like, you know, in college where people put the tie on the door handle and it's like, you don't go into the room when things are happening. Like, give them a break during this really critical period of the year or of the season. Then we actually wind up with far more animals in the sea for us to either eat for food security or gain medicines from. I mean, there's so much diversity and so many phenomenal chemicals that different animals in the ocean create for us that can fight cancers and heart disease and neurological disorders. It's a medicine chest that we're just starting to tap. All of that diversity, all of that abundance comes from the process of sex. So if we can just give them the chance to reproduce and help support their reproductive strategies by managing the oceans in a way that is in alignment with rather than sort of goes against, then we will all benefit from having healthier, thriving seas, you know, humans and marine life.
Wonderful. You know, one of the things I love about your book is it's they're broken up into acts, and there's dating games, sealing the deal, and different pieces of that, such as the penis chapter and inner chambers and oceanic orgies. What's going on with the groups out there, oceanic orgies? Are these sharks or fish? I think you were talking about grouper do this kind of big open thing.
Grouper's group. No, so oceanic orgies is a really common strategy for animals that have external fertilization. So we don't see this on land very much because in the air, sperm would dry out, as would eggs, if they were to sort of just be broadcast out into the wind. But in the ocean, animals can actually release their sperm and egg into the water, and sex actually is an out-of-body experience. The joining of sperm and egg happens in the water, in the ocean itself, rather than inside the female's body. Or I should say in the case of seahorse, the male's body, but that's another really cool tale. But when you're in the ocean, if you're releasing your eggs and sperm out there, you can imagine it's a very big ocean and there's currents and if you don't time things well, those little sperm and eggs are just going to get washed away and never find another sperm and egg to join with. So animals group up and they tend to do so based on environmental cues that they can all respond to. So we often see annual mass spawning events, groupers, snappers, other types of predatory fish tend to do this. So coming up in the Caribbean, for example, starting in December, we'll see the Nassau grouper will start making their annual migration. And they tend to go to very specific points. So for reef fish, it's often an outcrop. And you can have the entire adult population of one species around one island, for example, in one place at one time. And it's a way for these animals to be able to kind of get in sync with one another. And then they go through these remarkable spawning runs. So often it's timed with changes in water temperature, changes in moon cycles. So around the full moon, is a huge cue for sex in the sea in general. But in the Nassau grouper, they start to sort of, Little Cayman Island, they'll get together, and this is an endangered species, and it's one of the largest remaining spawning aggregations that we know of. And when scientists started to study them, they realized that every single adult from around Little Cayman Island, so over 3,000 of these individuals, were gathering at this tiny little outcrop on the southern tip of the island during the full moon in January and February. And they wait till sunset, And right as the sun goes down, the females will start to swim out off of the outcrop, so into the kind of open, deeper water, and she'll do this giant swimming arc. And at the top of the arc, she'll release her eggs. And then you have about 6 to 10 males that sort of rush after her, and then they'll release their sperm through her cloud of eggs. And so out of this population of several thousand fish, you get these little mini geysers of smaller groups that are shooting up off the bottom and going into these giant arcs. And within minutes, the visibility of the water goes from, you know, being able to see 100 to 200 feet to barely being able to see, you know, your hand in front of your face, because there's so much sperm and egg in the water that's being released by these fish. And it's the entire year's worth of reproduction happening around 30 minutes right at sunset for about 3 days around the full moon. And then that's it.
And unbelievable.
Then they, you know, disperse and go home. But you can imagine that if you're fishing at that time, it's highly disruptive. It's very lucrative because you have all of the biggest adults in one place at one time, but you're really disturbing the one chance those adults have to make the next generation. And the story of the Cayman Islands and the government in the Cayman Islands and researchers with the Reef Education Foundation, they've done some great work to actually protect and shut down fishing during this spawning period. And the result of that has been enormous increases in the population. And so fishermen are now realizing that they actually catch more fish the rest of the year by not fishing during this one, you know, closure period for a few weeks when the fish are reproducing. So there really can be win-wins when we learn to manage in a way that is supportive of these reproductive strategies rather than exploitative.
It's so interesting. I'm just thinking about the California Current and how the whole food web goes crazy in the springtime with the phytoplankton, the zooplankton, and the fishes releasing their eggs. And it's just interesting thinking about adaptive management strategies with reproduction. And if we know enough about some of these species, maybe we could actually take some measurement to help reduce some pressure on them.
Yes. Sustainable management has to include knowledge of the way these animals reproduce. And as we've sort of started to talk about, especially with some of these deep sea organisms, it's really different. It's so different than how mammals reproduce, which is what we're most familiar with, ourselves, our dogs, our cats, our farm animals. And so we've managed the oceans historically in a way that assumes reproduction in a very limited sense. And so we've gotten it wrong. And that's not, you know, that's not necessarily our fault. I mean, Ossidax worm, right? These zombie worms, who would have thought? There's harems of tiny, you know, microscopic dwarf males living inside a female. Like, this stuff is weird and it's hard to know. But putting the resources and supporting the science so that we can have science-based management and understanding systems is critical. And as we do so, we're finding we can have great success because they are resilient. Once we figure it out and we make those adjustments, these animals do come back. And the great thing about the oceans is that we have very few full extinctions, right? The raw potential for recovery and resiliency is all there. So we just have to work with it. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is really encouraging and exciting.
Yeah, that's why I really enjoy your topic, because it really does give so much hope for getting it right. We can get it right. There's so much resilience available, and a lot of it's just we don't know. It's under the water.
It's under the water, and it's hard to capture, right? We all know there's like sex is a fleeting thing. These intimate acts are intimate for a reason. They're often very secretive and hard to really understand. So it takes a little bit of effort, but man, is it fun when we start to figure this stuff out.
Well, I know there's been a lot of effort. We have about 5-7 minutes left here, but there's been a lot of effort to learn more about the path of the white sharks in California. We know they're very common in our waters near the coast and around the Farallon Islands this time of year, white sharks, because elephant seals are returning. And I've heard stories that I don't think there's any basis to about breeding grounds, and there's been this effort to go to an area where they go out in the Pacific near Hawaii called the White Shark Cafe that scientists down at Stanford are trying to learn more about. Why are they going there? They still don't really know.
Right.
And I'm wondering, could we talk a little bit about sharks? Because, everybody loves sharks, and it is very sharky around here right now.
It is very sharky.
There's been a lot of sightings and little nibbles here and there.
No, shark sex is, I think, probably one of my favorite topics. You know, sharks are really old, 450 million years old. There's over 450-ish species, so there's a lot of diversity there. But sharks, unlike the fish we were just talking about, which a lot of folks don't realize, they are internal fertilizers. So they actually reproduce much more like a mammal than a fish. And what's really neat is that in sharks, you can actually, as it's very easy to tell a boy from a girl shark. So if you ever have the opportunity, you know, at an aquarium where, especially where they have those tanks where there, you can kind of walk underneath like those tunnels, you know, and look up. If you look at the underside of a shark, back by the tail, there are two pelvic fins. And on the female, you'll just see the basic shape of the fin. And on the male, you'll see two very distinct, elongate, cigar-shaped claspers. They look like penises, and that's really their function. It's an elongation of the fin that kind of rolls around like a burrito. And this is the way that the male inserts that clasper into the female, and she has an opening that's like a vagina. It's called a cloaca. And they have to get together. It's often quite rough, shark sex. Females actually have thicker skin than males to deal with the fact that the males often will bite down on their fins to roll the female into place. So she has this thicker hide, if you will, to protect her. And then the males roll the female, and then they actually insert the clasper into the female and deposit the sperm. But what's really cool about sharks is that unlike a mammal penis, where you have a tube that runs from the testes, so where the sperm are produced, to the end of the penis, with sharks, that clasper is hollow. It's literally just a fin rolled around itself. And the sperm comes out of a pore at the base of the male's tail. So there's no really great way for the sperm to kind of get down the clasper and into the female. So what has happened is sharks have evolved to have this kind of use their water environment. And so what the males do is they actually can suck up seawater through another tiny pore opening at the base of their tail, and they have sacs that run the length of their body internally. The sac fills up with seawater, and then they squirt that seawater out using muscular contractions at a very high-powered kind of stream, and that water pore is right next to the sperm pore. So as the shark releases its sperm and ejaculates, they squeeze these internal sacs and shoot a beam of water that then flushes the sperm into the clasper, down the clasper, and into the female.
Hmm.
So it's this crazy, like, super soaker water gun type of sex ejaculation. And it's a really unique way that sharks deal with having internal fertilization.
Interesting.
So from the males, it's a really funky adaptation. And then in females, oh my gosh, we could talk for ages. The females have shark females, some species can have virgin birth, so they can actually reproduce without any male contribution at all.
How does that work? I've never understood that.
Well, you played the Like a Virgin song, so I was like, yay, virgin birth. So it's called parthenogenesis, and it means virgin birth in Greek or Latin. Maybe Greek. I can't remember. But the females, basically, what happens is the egg can divide with itself. The egg itself splits and then reunites. So it's just maternal DNA, but the DNA does mix. So you do get a little bit of diversity happening. It's not as much genetic diversity as you'd get from two separate individuals, but there is some mixing. And then that reformed egg can grow into a viable offspring. And what we see is we first started to notice this virgin birth potential in aquarium sharks. So females that had been isolated from males for a long time and all of a sudden were reproducing. And we thought that it was a kind of a stress response when the females could not find a male. But then recently we found, about 2 years ago, I think now, some researchers, one of the scientists' name is Dean Grubbs, and they were out studying the endangered sawfish, which is actually a shark, and they found that the female, they were able to catch a pregnant female who actually gave birth while the researchers were tagging her to live young, and they were able to get DNA from the live young and from the female, the mother, and the DNA showed that those pups only had the mother's DNA. And this is an endangered species, and so it's the first evidence we have that in the wild, these females may be using this technique to reproduce as they're struggling to find mates. And the good news is, by doing this, it could be a little bit of like a stopgap, right? They are increasing their numbers. Over the long term, virgin birth is not healthy because, again, you're not getting as much genetic diversity as you need. Also, the process is such that you only get one sex, so they only have daughters. You can only have a daughter shark through parthenogenesis. So, again, your sex ratio can get skewed in the long term. But in the short term, it means that there is some reproduction happening in that population, and if we can then kind of reduce the other threats on that species, it means that perhaps there's a greater chance of recovery than we had thought. So, yeah, virgin birth, it happens in the wild. It happens in aquaria. There's also really cool sperm storage. So some females can actually, sharks can actually store sperm for over 2 to 3 years and then draw upon that sperm to reproduce when they feel the conditions are right. Yeah, just some fascinating techniques out there that actually mean that females have a lot more control over what is happening in their sex lives than we had previously thought.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. That's just so cool. we probably just have about 2 or 3 minutes, so we should probably wrap it up. But where can folks keep up with some of the work that you do or read some other of other pieces that you've written?
Oh, well, I do try to keep an active blog on sexinthesea.org, where I continue to learn from all the great research that's out there and try to present the fun and fascinating world of Sex and the Sea for folks to learn from and encourage folks to check that out. And otherwise, you know, there's amazing research being done out of so many different organizations, and especially things like the marine sanctuaries. I mean, these are the natural laboratories that we get to use to see how life happens when we aren't necessarily putting as much impact or influence into the ocean as we tend to do in other places. And so the research coming out of National Marine Sanctuaries and the observations just from folks who get to go and dive and explore these amazing protected habitats is a huge source of inspiration on not just sex, but just the incredible work and lives that these scientists lead as they explore the amazing marine habitat that is, you know, the vast majority of our planet. 99% of the habitable space of our world is in the ocean. And it's just endless, the discoveries that are coming. I mean, Nautilus.org is another great example. You know, forget been watching on Netflix for right now and just go tune into that because you have no idea what's going to come next.
I know. It's so exciting. Mm-hmm. Omar, it's so much fun to interview you. I really appreciate you coming on again to Ocean Currents, and I really look forward to being in touch again to hopefully
absolutely
have more of you sharing your knowledge.
Anytime. I think it's an awesome podcast, and you know, I'm a huge fan of public radio, being able to share the important news and stories of our time. So happy to be here and really appreciate, and I'm humbled that you asked me back. So thanks.
Thank you so much. And we really appreciate you being part of KWMR.
Anytime.
All right. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
I just want to say thanks to everybody. And Ocean Currents is the first Monday of every month, 11 to 12. And you can check out the podcast in iTunes for all the 100-plus episodes we've had here at KWMR. And thank you for listening. Enjoy the ocean, bay, or whatever body of water you can get into safely. This is KWMR Plant Radio Station. Thank you for listening to Ocean Currents. This show is brought to you by NOAA's Cordell Bank National Marine Sanctuary on West Marine Community Radio, KWMR. Views expressed by guests on this program may or may not be that of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and are meant to be educational in nature. To contact the show's host, Jennifer Stock, email me at jennifer.stock@noaa.gov. To learn more about Cordell Bank National Marine Sanctuary, go to cordellbank.noaa.gov.